Okay, Dave, what's the PSA?
The PSA is if you're under the age of 40 and you don't want to have high cholesterol, eat a salad.
Very
eat
good.
Multiple salads.
Oh, excellent.
You're listening to Ryan Anderson's Model Railcast Show with your hosts, Craig Bisgeier and Tim Harrison. We're bringing you the latest news, reviews, and interviews on the hobby of model railroading. The Model Railcast Show, keeping you on the right track.
All right, Model Railcasters, we've got show 230. Craig is traveling, but I do have a guest co-host tonight, and you know him as Uncle Larry. Lawrence, how you doing?
Well, sir, how about you?
Doing okay. It's a little bit hot up here, but it's not 90 degrees at least.
It is 90 degrees here. You have zero sympathy for me.
Yeah, and of course, New Jersey, at least South Jersey, is the land of humidity, so it's not just hot, but it's also just very swampy, too.
Yeah, same here.
Yeah, so. And Model Railcasters, we also have back on a fan favorite, Dave Ramos. Dave, how are you doing?
Doing well.
Excellent, excellent. I was going through some of the old shows, and I think the last show you were on was show 205, but that's going back about 2 or 3 years ago, I think, and that was actually before... You were still in discussion mode about whether or not you were going to do that staging or not.
Oh, that staging's been in now for about a year.
Yeah.
It was supposed to be a 6-month project. Took 18, actually 22, but who's counting? And it's in there and it's running really well.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So, Brother Lawrence, so do you have an update for us? What's going on your model railroad?
I've been playing with some new Arduino controls and in the form of sensors and relays. The sensors are an ambient light sensor that seems to work very, very well. And it will it adapts to ambient light. And I threw a YouTube video out today about a grade crossing circuit using those. And have a couple other things going on with the Arduinos.
Gotcha.
So, now other than that, it's kind of the routine.
Right, right. Excellent. Well, for me, I finally, I still have some more work to do, but I was working on a curved turnout ladder extension for Bolson Street Yard, and it came out okay, except the wheel set kind of hops up on the frog a little bit, so I've got some more filing to do to help that out. It didn't quite curve the frog enough, so I've got... I can either rip it out of there, or I could try filing it. So I tried filing it, and the wheel set seemed to be a little bit happier, but still got some hemming and hawing over that. So, but it looks good. I just need it to run good now. So that's what's happening there. And try to do some rail fanning, local rail fanning around the area, and just try and take in some trains whenever I can't work on them. And traffic is still about the same, even though with the economy, it's still pretty regular down this area. So that is what's going on with me. We'll round that up for updates, and we're going to just jump right on into the roundhouse section with Dave Ramos.
Three, 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 two, two, 1.
Dave, it has been a while since we've had you on. Firstly, how are you doing, and how's everything going in Clifton?
Well, everything in Clifton is going well. Since last time I was on, I'm now 100 pounds lighter and doing really well. Yeah, not easy. The problem with losing 100 pounds, now I'm cold all the time, which is actually paying off about now. but the railroad itself is running. Continually doing more improvements on it, changing things around, added some sidings at 33rd Street, putting some scenery in. I just put in a mock roof line up on the High Line over by St. John's Park. It's just tall enough so you get the feeling that it's in a canyon. Working on Cudahy Building, so it's actually now an actual building. I have the ends done. I'm starting to put the roof in and the walls in to make it look like a meat processing plant. So you see the sides of beef. I've gotten a bunch of those, and I'm going to build a meat rack so that you can get a couple of butchers and have them pushing the meat into the facility. And I'm planning to start modeling Nabisco and start modeling merchants. Nice. And working the bugs out of the rest of the layout. Finally have the transition track that goes from the Lehigh Valley to Terminal Stores, and got some new equipment and new decoders on some of the older equipment, and everything seems to be running really well. I don't know if you know Phil Monat. He used to be president of the OPSIG. He was kind enough to paint six RS-1 shells for me. So now they'll be, I'm going to get rid of some of the patchwork stuff and put the new RS-1 shells in with the lightning stripes, because he was very capable of putting the lightning stripes on. My lightning stripes looked like somebody put tape on a machine on the side of the RS-1.
Okay. Uncle Larry, have you met Phil Monat ever?
No, sir, I have not.
The man is an artist. Would that be like the mild way to describe him, Dave?
Yeah, you can call him that. He's also known as the man with his hair on fire.
Yeah. The Energizer Bunny, I take it.
Yeah, the Energizer Bunny can't keep up with him. He also, when he hand lays a track, he doesn't use templates or stuff like that. He eyeballs it, and then he gauges it after it's all eyeballed, so it looks right, and then it runs perfectly. So that's one of the interesting things about somebody who takes a different approach to track laying. About the only issue we've ever had with his, some of the tracks he's put in is when the humidity gets very high down there, we had to cut expansion gaps. And then that fixed every issue we had with any of the big switches. We have a couple of very large curve turnouts that he built that basically the comment that was made about them is frogs aren't supposed to be an exponent number. And these things are huge, and they run well.
Number 37, eh?
Could be.
Oh, man. Very cool. Very cool. Well, just for some of our newer listeners, Dave, what is, if you could describe the New York Harbor Railroad for our newer listeners, what would you tell them?
Well, it's basically four layouts in one. You have the High Line, which is an independent layout that runs by itself. That's New York Central, that runs on a fast clock and uses waybills. You have 33rd Street, which is also part of, or 30th Street, actually, which is also part of the New York Central. It also runs on the fast clock and has waybills. And then you have two additional car float yards, which are independent. They run with switch lists, and the only time they'll use a waybill is both the Lehigh Valley, the Erie, and the New York Central switch out one building, which is called Terminal Stores. And so in order to keep track of who has what, that building uses waybills, so that's the only actual waybill that will be used on the Erie's 28th Street or Lehigh Valley's 27th Street. I repowered all the locomotives for the Erie and the Lehigh Valley since last time you were here. I now have an HH660, which has a Tsunami 2 with the 539 turbo, and I just picked up a brand new Atlas S2 that has an ESU Loke sound decoder, I believe, and it's also 539 turbo, and that one runs really well. I ran it on Facebook Live last week with my friend Ralph Heiss. We were doing car float.
Yes.
Yeah, and I broke the cardinal sin, which is cleaning the track with a liquid cleaner and not wiping up the liquid, so it gummed up the it coated the wheels on the new S2, and then once I cleaned them, cleaned the wheels on the S2, it was fine. Of course, that was after the video.
Right.
So the joke was every time it stalled, we had to take a hit. We had to take a drink. I basically got poured into bed that night, but it was good. We had a lot of fun. That's the name of the game with the pandemic. We've been having fun. Ralph and I have, basically he's been coming out and braving it. And then, we've been talking about working on his layout and all that. So it's been an interesting thing. I have one more car float left for the 27th Street, and I have two car floats left for 28th Street. And then I have a full set of, trains ready to go for the High Line and 33rd Street. And my next op session, unless the governor comes down here and says you can't have one, it's going to be July 3rd, which is a Friday, obviously before July 4th weekend.
Right.
And we're going to be in phase two as far as Monday, so it should be no problem. And according to the current regulations, it's 25 or less, and I only need about 10 people to operate it.
Right.
But what's really interesting, I kid people, specifically my friend Ralph, I kid him with variable geometry track.
Just this track I remember.
It's not glued down or nailed down so that, you know, you get somebody like me who, like, I want to go to another track and there's no switch, so I just unhook it and move it over and then hook it back in and then put it back because, you can't keep a good jerk down. So what I have is what I have is variable size operators. So I don't need to have a crew of 12. I could operate with as little as 1 or 2 or 4 or 3 or 7 or up to 12. So that has been both a blessing and a curse because when I don't feel like having a large crew over to do that, I'll invite one or two people over, and that's okay. But when I have a full session and I have, with the weather or people getting sick, basically having shortfalls on crews, then it gets a little tight to run everything. And usually at that point is we bake some brownies and, break out another bottle of bourbon and everybody's happy. And
yes.
we run as long as we do. What's really funny is that I believe it should be entertaining and fun, not a job, because I work hard enough as it is. When I'm at work getting paid for it. So when people come to my layout, I want them to enjoy themselves and have fun. I want them to understand where they are, what's going on. It's the west side of Manhattan, basically three square blocks and a linear mile of the High Line. So if you get an idea where it is, it's if anybody's ever seen the movie An Affair to Remember, there's a scene where in the very beginning of the movie where Deborah Kerr and Cary Grant go sailing past Terminal Stores, and it's white. 1947, that movie was filmed, and I had a photograph of it from 1945, and it was brown. And of course, when I did the Photoshop model, I used that image, and so it was brown. And then that movie was filmed in 47, and it's white. And I'm like, no, because you can't paint a Photoshop building,
right?
Just turns it into a piece of white paper. But it was really interesting. You could see the yard and the way it was running back then. And there's another movie by John Cassavetes and Sidney Poitier, which takes place just after World War II. It's called The Edge of the City. And it's filmed in New York Central's 30th Street yard. And it's pretty interesting because you get to see what the yard looked like. And I know people don't like bells on their locomotives running all the time, but that was the regs. and the regulations. And when you watch the movie, the one thing that drives you up the wall is the ding, ding, ding of the S2s rolling around the yard.
Right.
And so it is what it is. And that's I don't make the guys have the S2s with the bells all the time.
Right, right. Well, because you want them to have fun.
Yeah, but that's basically the layout in a nutshell of what's going on. It's four separate layouts that come together as one.
Right, right. And, Lawrence, have you had a chance? Have you been up here and had seen the New York Harbor Railroad?
I have not. I've been up there, but I have not seen the New York Harbor. That's on my want-to list.
Gotcha, gotcha. Yeah, it's definitely good. And you guys are both modeling New York Central, so.
And we are.
So, excellent. So, Dave, how important were the car float operations for places like New York City?
Well, with the exception of the New York Central, every other railroad got its freight from New Jersey into or Staten Island into New York City by rail barge or by lighter. So in the city of New York, it was basically before the George Washington Bridge was built, it was one of the only ways to get meat, produce, cargo from the other side of the United States into New York City. A lot of the shipping that would come into New York would be coming from overseas, South America, you know, banana boats, things like that, cargo coming in from Europe. You know, everything coming from Asia Pacific would be hitting Los Angeles and be shipped across the United States, mm-hmm. even back then, or go through the Panama Canal. So in order to get goods into New York, you had to come in by car float. One of the interesting things is fresh fruits, vegetables, would be auctioned off at the piers in Lower Manhattan. So that would come over by the Erie and other railroads, also the Lehigh Valley. The car floats were more than – they also had ferry boats for passengers to come and work into New York. Just like today, there's only the Pennsylvania tunnels, which were built, I believe, in 1909 or 1919. I can never remember the date on those. And then the Hudson tunnels, which are now the PATH tunnels. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much it. And then you had later on you had the Holland and the Lincoln. And then later on the George, but pretty much in order to get freight into Manhattan until the Hell's Gate Bridge was built, the only way to get anything in is you had to go north to Poughkeepsie, cross over on onto the mainland on that side, on our side of the Hudson, and then come down and come into Manhattan that way over Spuyt and Duyvil. Or going to the Bronx, and that was pretty much it. And the car float operations were all over the city, from Staten Island to Brooklyn to Queens to the Bronx and Manhattan, of course. And a lot of this stuff, like the Erie and the Lehigh Valley and the B&O, were all proposed in the 1890s and built like in 1909, 1915, so it's that period. So incidentally, a lot of people were wondering, always ask me, why there's so many parking lots. Well, not anymore, because they're now being turned into large buildings. But in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s until the early 2000s, there was all these vacant lots or large open lots by the waterfront, which a lot of people didn't understand why they were there. And most of those were rail yards.
Okay.
And the ones that are not connected to the Long Island or Amtrak were pretty much vacant. Which what used to be the New York Central, are pretty much vacant, and then those were used for parking lots later on.
Okay.
And it's a pretty interesting, thing growing up in New York, and you're seeing buildings everywhere. And by the time the railroads died out and were no longer shipping stuff via car float or rail car to New York City, the city was in the middle of a major bankruptcy and very hard times, and there was no more building in New York. Now everything is starting, and now things are coming back. There's a lot of money in New York, and except for either your regularly scheduled pandemic, which is basically stopping everything.
Right.
But it's actually one of the interesting things is that a lot of people don't realize it's 101 years since the last pandemic. And I actually had never been interested in World War I that much, or just after World War I. And I was looking at some photographs because somebody was sending me some photographs of Long Island Railroad, because I've always been grew up in Long Island, so I've always been a fan of Long Island. And just now I started looking at pictures from 1919, 1920, and I'm seeing people in New York City with face masks.
Oh, wow.
So the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Wow.
Of course, they were fighting the you talk about fake news now, that, you know, the coronavirus. The Spanish flu was not from Spain. The Spanish were actually the first to say, hey, there's something going on, but they got tagged with it as the Spanish flu. It actually, I believe, came from Topeka, Kansas. I'm not 100% sure, but I know it came from the United States. It was something that happened in the middle of the country and then spread like wildfire, because I have to do a little bit more research on it. But it's very interesting the way pandemics just run around the world.
Right, right, man. So following on that, how long were the car floats roughly in operation?
Up until 76. Some of them are still in operation today. The New York Cross Harbor still floats cars across. Again, for the same reason, it's a slightly different reason now, mostly having to do with getting subway cars into New York City. Mm-hmm. But there are some spots in Brooklyn and Bay Ridge that receive center flow hoppers. So it's still happening today. I mean, there's videos posted on Facebook of car float operations almost daily.
Okay.
It's not as the, you know, like we're feeding the city like it was in the 50s and
right.
the 40s, but it's still there because there's a lot of traffic that I found as interesting, cocoa to make chocolate.
Yeah.
And but apparently, one, it's very caustic. It tends to be very caustic. Some of the stuff that leaches from it, so it's transported now in food grade center flow hoppers. Also, I've been told, and again, I haven't read anything of this, but I've been told by one of the railroad guys who works at the Cross Harbor, is the truckers don't like it because they get creepy crawlies in there, like spiders and things like that.
Man.
But we're talking about South American spiders, which are like not as bad as Australian spiders, but you know they're still, you know, so it's just easier to transport them that way. You know, you have to deal with them in the bags and all that. And they come up from Mexico that way, I believe, or they're transloaded from a ship in Florida or something like that. Of course, you have some interesting accidents because apparently center flows float.
Oh.
there's a really great picture of one in Brooklyn. I guess the locomotive was pushing too hard, and when you push too hard against the cars on the car float, the point of failure is the ropes that hold it in place and the chains, and they pop off, and they have these bars that basically allow you to align the car float to the float bridge, but it doesn't really lock the car float to the float bridge, so you could shoot the float bridge out into the East River or into Hudson.
Oh, man. How long did it take to clean that up?
I don't know. They really don't. That didn't make the news that day.
Okay.
But I saw pictures of it, and you could clearly see the centerfolds floating, and I thought they were empty, but then they said, no, they're full. It's just there's air in them, which keeps them up.
Well, Uncle Larry, do you have any questions for Dave as we're going along? And if you do, or if one comes up, please don't hesitate to insert it. It's not a one-man show here.
I got one question.
Sure.
Hey, Dave, how do we convert him away from that Penzi thing he's into?
That you need an exorcism. Penzi's almost like a religion, just like New York Central is almost a religion.
Yeah, almost.
The only thing you need for the triumvirate, you need a Santa Fe guy.
Well,
I was going to say UP, but that's another story.
Yeah.
Well, at least it's not as bad as it used to be. Now it's PRSL, you know, so it's like I could almost be considered a Reading modeler at this point. Oh, you know, you will never...
If that's your story, we'll let you stick with it.
I will say this. I am a Penzi guy who completely blames the Penzi for the fall of the Penn Central. I don't blame New York Central one bit.
Yeah, well, no, New York Central management was involved in that.
Yeah, it was. That was an equal cluster, but that's another story.
That's another podcast. Yeah.
That's a 3 week podcast.
That's one that has to be discussed with a bunch of pies laying around.
Yes.
That sounds terrific, actually. Wait, you mean the pies you can eat, I'm guessing, right? Or pie chunks?
Yeah. No, pies, you know, like a pie fight.
Yes, okay.
See, this needs to make the show.
It will. I like it. So, Dave, you've touched on it a little bit, but as you know, it's been about 2 years since we talked to you last, and so what new has happened on the New York Harbor Railroad since then?
Well, I was convinced to put in new staging, mm-hmm. so we put in a double-deck staging yard that was underneath the High Line, which required us rejiggering the High Line coming out of staging, so now it has to climb at a 2.25%, okay. which is still nowhere near what the prototype can do. And I can tell you for a fact that the original run of Atlas RS1s can pull a 22-car train up the 2.25%, 2.5%, depending on where you are, grade without an issue. The second run, I'm talking about, this is the old one where everything is you know, you could basically use it as a weapon.
Right.
The second run, which was the yellow, which is not the yellow box, but with the one that replaced the yellow box. I'm trying to remember what it was, because I've never actually got one in a box. I've always got them outside, you know, I've always bought them secondhand. They could pull up 18, and then the black box ones, when they started coming on the black box, can pull 17. And then when they started putting the word classic on them, they could pull about 16. And then the new ones could pull 12.
Okay, wow.
So that's the difference in actual pulling strength out of the box. My collection is now up to 17. They only had 14, so I have three extra.
Okay.
I had a double head, everything coming out on the High Line, I had a double head, which is not what the prototype did. But in order to operate, and my concern is that it works, that the operator turns the knob and it moves up the hill. I'm a firm believer that if they're pushing your train up the hill, no matter how nice the layout is, you're having an issue with it, you have to fix it.
Right.
That's something I'm not happy with, and eventually that'll be fixed. I'll do something with those. Besides that, I'm starting to add roof details so that when you're on the High Line, you're actually looking over the tops of buildings instead of looking straight onto the track like you're used to. I have the backdrop walls of buildings. A lot of them are up. I'm working on some of the actual three-dimensional buildings, which are actually boxes, which are fairly large.
Mm-hmm.
I had sticker shock because I have 1,500 windows on terminal stores. And I asked somebody about laser cutting the windows because no commercial manufacturer makes windows of that type. And when he told me the number, I'm like, well, maybe it'll be cheaper to buy my own laser. And it actually was.
Wow.
So if you know how much a laser costs, this is getting a laser, making my own windows, and I would be ahead of the game by a few $100s. Not a couple of bucks, a few $100s. So that's on hold. So that's going to be a Photoshop building for a while. It was really interesting is that I'm starting to work on the Miller Expressway, or what people used to know as the West Side Highway.
Okay.
So I'm going to put that in front of the I'm going to put that in front of 28th Street, and I'm going to have it going in front of 27th Street, so that you have the feeling that you're in the street. The next thing I'm working on after that is cobblestone. And the projected finish date is middle of next year to okay. have as much scenery as I can get in and have it to that point. I don't know when the next Pro Rail in New Jersey is going to be, but I'm hopefully going to participate in that. We do a thing called the Interchange, which is basically the guys in D.C. and in Baltimore area and us, we swap op sessions. So this year they're coming up to New Jersey. Next year we go down there and so on. And so that's, I'm looking forward to hosting that. And I believe I mentioned earlier that July 3rd I'm going to have an op session. I plan to have about 10 people here.
Excellent.
And I already have some people coming in from New England for it, so it should be a lot of fun. And you know, everything else is going well. I mean, I'm still working on stuff. I'm learning how to solder without burning myself, which is always a really good thing. Which is interesting. I don't burn myself when I'm building track. I only burn myself when I'm soldering decoders in, because you know it's a little traumatic for my fingers when I see that. And I picked up a couple of Arduinos and some power shields. And, you know, I've done some clinics on the do-it-yourself DCC, so I have a standalone DCC++ unit that I built. I've been helping some friends out with their layouts. Phil Monat, I just built him a computer to run JMRI and Wi-Fi throttle for him. I did the same for a few other people. I have a Raspberry Pi. I just got a new one that is running my Wi-Fi downstairs. So instead of having to have a computer and a router, I just have a Raspberry Pi, which basically when you come down, it handles everything. You connect to it with your phone,
right,
and you're able to operate. And I try to explain to people that one of the interesting things about the Raspberry versus, you know, your NCE throttles is the throttle bus throughput for the wireless stuff is like 1/10 of the bandwidth that you have with your phone. So, and it directly communicates to the command station. So it doesn't have to go to a receiver, which then that puts it down to the command bus and sends it to the command station. This bypasses all that and goes right in through the COM port, right to the command station, goes out. So it cuts out one, you know, basically the command station actually having to receive the commands through the command bus that way. And I don't know if I'm explaining it correctly, but...
Well, the command bus is about 10% on a really good day,
yep,
of what your Wi-Fi throughput is.
Yep.
So on a standard USB... it's about 5 times what the command bus is. So when, yeah, you eliminate that command bus connection, everything speeds up. And you'll find everything works a lot better. I've installed a couple of Pis in the past months on customers' layouts, and the new versions just are stunning. The Raspberry Pi 4 is a new level.
Yeah, that's what I just picked up. I picked up a Raspberry Pi 4B Plus with 4 gigabytes of RAM.
Yeah.
And the only thing that just got me annoyed is that I have an older monitor that has a DVI cable.
Yeah.
And it turned out that it was a couple of bucks to get a DVI to HDMI converter. I'm sorry, a mini cable.
Yeah.
HDMI to HDMI converter so that I could plug in my old cable and use it, but it's really a magnitude faster and much more responsive than and one of the things I'm planning on doing, I'm going to the MRPM and I'm planning to do what I call a live fire exercise, which is basically I have a brand new Arduino, I have a brand new Arduino motor shield, and I'm going to have my older Raspberry Pi, and the clinic will be, except for the Raspberry Pi, unboxing them, putting them together, putting the DCC++ in it, putting the whole unit together, and running a train by the end of the clinic. So it literally is ridiculously simple,
yep,
to do it. I mean, the hardest thing is getting onto GitHub and downloading the firmware for the DCC++ and pushing it to the Arduino, which is here's a very important note for anybody who's thinking about doing it. Do not use a USB hub unless it's a powered USB hub or an active USB hub, because the Arduino will fail. It will give you some failures. Hook it up directly to your computer, laptop. And it doesn't make a difference whether you have a Mac or a PC or a desktop or a laptop. The software is universal. The name of the software to push it is called the Arduino IDE software, and it's available from the Arduino site. If you're interested, anybody interested in getting parts, Amazon has them all in stock. To do the DCC++ with minus the power supply for the layout, you're talking about under $40.
Wow.
Yep.
And then you could basically hook it up if you have a laptop. So if you have somebody who's got a little DIY in them that they could do this stuff, don't have $500 to lay out for an NCE system, but have a good phone, a tablet, a laptop or a computer, that has USB, that's the only major requirement. You could literally pick one of these up for about $40 with the power shield, and then you can get a 6-amp 14-volt power supply, which is usually Toshiba and HP. There's one other manufacturer that has power supply for their laptops, and it's a 30-cent, or I'm sorry, it's a 90-cent piece that you have to buy that you plug the power supply into, and it converts it to two-wire. So you could plug it into the Arduino, or you could cut the end off the power supply and then just put those wires in there. And basically, for under $60, you could have a DCC system that is will run JMRI and run something called DCC++. You could consist. So, I mean, there's really no reason why you can't go to... go and have put DCC in any system. The price restrictions are pretty much gone now. The coders cost more than the DCC system. Let's put it like that.
Yep, by far. Yeah, one caveat I'll give you, Dave, is you can get around that powered USB hub if it's a USB 3.0 hub and you're on a USB 3.0 output on your PC. That's the only way you can get around it.
Yeah, well, the machine I was using is a seven-year-old machine with USB 2.
Yeah, no USB 3.0. Yeah.
And so, and it was the right price. It was free.
Yeah, I've got a couple of those.
In fact, about the only thing I have actually purchased, because it was hand-me-downs from where I used to work, the only thing I've actually purchased is a laptop, which my lovely bride bought me a SSD drive for my birthday. And I have to tell you, it's night and day difference on how fast it is in comparison to what it was with their standard hard drive. But that's the newest piece of hardware I have, not including the Raspberry Pis. And you just can't be afraid to get your hands on these things. And with me, it was like we had a really bad snowstorm, and I was poking my head through YouTube, and I came across these videos on it, and I was very, you know, like, hey, I can do that. And I usually get in trouble when I see something like that, and I go, hey, I can do that. And I did, and I've done a couple of clinics, and what's really funny is that when I have this DCC++ demonstration that I do at the clinics, I don't actually build it there. That's what I'm planning to do different this year, is to actually build it on site so everybody can see it being built. And basically showing the sausage being made, so it's taking that whole mystery out of it.
Right.
But part of the things that really is a kicker is that people see this. They see the Wi-Fi password that I use, and I have one locomotive and 25 people attached to it. Oh, and this is a Raspberry Pi 3B. And the locomotive is literally having seizures because it's receiving... like 40 different commands, the bells going off, the whistles going off, the lights. It's like somebody's playing Saturday Night Fever inside the cab because the lights are going on and off. It's kind of interesting, but it's a fun clinic. I've had a lot of fun with it, and I'm hoping that the COVID-19 does not cancel the MARPM. It's a good one. I'm planning on going. I'm not sure how many, you know, I talked to Bernie Kapinski, and I gave him a commitment. I was definitely going to go.
Right.
I owe him, Bernie, I'm sorry I haven't sent it yet, but I owe him a description, and basically anybody heard what I'm going to do.
Right.
And, the other thing is we also, my friend Ted and I, at Scary Ted Diorio.
Oh, yes.
would D lowercase I uppercase I, and he and Rio, and he hates Arial font because the uppercase I looks like an L, so everybody calls him Delorio, and he hates it. So, but we do weathering, and the one thing that I really enjoy is weathering all the stuff and just talking to people. And just it, so we're gonna probably do a weathering clinic and have fun with that. But that's primarily what I'm gonna be doing with my time at this point. Since like every RPM, every train show, you know, every bat mitzvah, every funeral has been canceled due to until better weather. So,
right.
You know, hopefully those days are coming.
Yeah, I know that Bernie is keeping, I mean, he said it's still happening, and I know he's not gonna cancel until he has no option. I mean, he's gonna do everything he can to keep it going. So, so that, at least that's his desire. So hopefully, that I know I'm absolutely just can't wait for the Marpum. So I will be devastated if it's not gonna happen. It's just such a great show.
Well, after that, the only thing that I have on my books besides my own operating session is, like I said, we have the interchange with DC. They're coming up to New Jersey. Now, the only problem is that what the people are predicting is if there is a second wave, it's going to hit around November, which would be really terrible.
Yeah.
But you got to do what you got to do. You got to stay safe.
Yep. That's true.
Yep.
Are you planning Uncle Lawrence? Lawrence, Brother Lawrence, are you planning on going to the Marpum?
If I can get my microphone unmuted, yes.
I
am hoping to go to Marpum. It is on my list of want to do just because so many of my friends are going to be there. You two being on that list, of course. And it's about a 12-hour drive for me.
Gotcha.
Connecticut. I know how to drive fast. I just have slowed down in my elder years.
Have you seen the video that was on YouTube about the New York State Trooper, I think it was? And he's sitting there, and he's hitting people with the speed gun, seeing how fast they're going. And he's like, well, he's doing 60. Well, he might have COVID, so I'm not pulling him over. He's doing 75. He definitely has COVID. I'm not pulling him over. And then the other thing, he goes, like, somebody goes by at 90. He goes, I should really pull him over. Oh, he's gone. He probably had COVID. He got in trouble because apparently you could see the reflection of his badge number in the window. So it's, but I'm like sitting there. It's his honesty right there. Boom.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh man. All right. So, Dave, especially this is going to apply to some of our newer listeners, but even for some of our old ones, it's a good refresher. Now, there's some names on New York Harbor that everybody still knows, like Swift, Neitz, Nabisco. But then there's some other names like R.C. Williams or Terminal Stores that I can think of in particular. Terminal Stores to me has been one of the most fascinating. But for the listeners, what did those places do? What was their bag?
Well, we'll start off with Terminal Stores. Terminal Stores was built in conjunction with the New York Central and a local real estate company. And it was built in 1871. And the whole idea was to have it as a city block size industrial park where basically they could deliver freight to different customers in there. There were some grocers in there. There was a steel company that got wire and steel parts, not beams, mostly, you know, things that would come in a boxcar. There was also an express company. That building is still there. It's a high-end mall now. It was a fireproof building that had a fire partially collapsed, and they rebuilt it so that it was really fireproof. It's a very interesting building. Like I said, it's still there. They had an enormous American flag that flew over it, and they also had a white flag with a red star that was on a triangular pennant that flew over it. That was over on the 11th Avenue side. So if you see pictures of a building with that, that's probably it. The flagpole, I think, was 7 to 10 inches thick.
Wow.
And the mounting is still there for it. It's got an arch entrance on both ends, and The brakemans used to ride the tops of the boxcars in with a steam train coming in from the New York Central or the Erie or the Lehigh Valley, and there was 22 sidings. There was 11 buildings on either side of the building and a large ice plant. That building I represent there with the, I believe I have 11. I do have 22 sidings, 22 spots.
Right.
Not sidings. So it's basically two tracks, and it can hold 22 cars end to end on those two tracks. So it's 11-11. Besides that, you were talking about R.C. Williams. And now what happened in the city is, again, produce, meats, milk, vinegar, wine, all this stuff had to come into the city somehow. And R.C. Williams was one of these companies that basically when they built the High Line, they built they had a large distributorship building that was right next to where they were building the High Line. So they, instead of receiving the freight at street level, they opened up the building at the third floor, and they had a siding there for them to receive the freight into the building. Sadly, with the rebuild of the High Line Park, the only two buildings that are still there besides the Chelsea Markets, which is Nabisco, and New York Merchants Refrigerating, the only one that's left that you could tell that still looks like it did when it was the railroad was there was R.C. Williams.
Okay.
It's a very classy looking building. And then this Spear and Company was a little brick building, which is pretty much almost across from it. And that's the company that invented cubicles, not invented, but basically sold cubicles, office furniture. Mm. They're there. That building is still there, although I think it's being renovated or changed into something else. But everything else that was classic, like the 19th century buildings, are all gone at this point. They've all been replaced. So unfortunately, walking the High Line pretty much, you just walk in the park now.
It's, right.
It lost a lot of the charm that I'm concerned with. Some all of that stuff is gone. The interesting thing is that Cudahy's still there. You can walk through it, but now it's a little mall.
Okay.
And then when you go to what used to be Nabisco, that's still there, but that's Chelsea Market. Again, it's a mall. And you still see the tracks going into Merchants. And unfortunately, the High Line was physically cut at Manhattan Refrigerating,
right,
which is Van Groot Street. And what's there is now the Whitney Museum, and you can go onto the roof of the Whitney and look north up on the High Line so you can get a good bird's eye view. The old AT&T building where they did all their research is still there and still has the trestle with the tracks going through it. But those have been cut off. All that stuff was cut off. And then, sadly, St. John's Park is partially gone. It's being turned into a high-rise. And so everything – I modeled it, and I took the photographs at the right time. All that stuff is starting to disappear now.
Wow.
So a lot of the classic buildings are gone. And, of course, you know, instead of building a football stadium that would bring 80,000 people, what is it? Well, it's the Jets, so eight times a year, no chance of a playoff game. So maybe a Super Bowl, so maybe nine times a year.
Right.
I love my Jets, but the last time they won anything, I was six. So they built, instead of that, they built a housing and industry that brings a couple hundred thousand people every day. So okay. I can understand why, you know, you want a couple hundred thousand every day instead of just the 80,000 nine times a year.
Right.
Plus the concerts and stuff like that. But it's so what's left there is the only thing that's really left today is terminal stores. So if you go there and if you go to Manhattan, you want to look at it, that's pretty much it. Mm. Everything else is pretty much gone. There's a couple of really interesting buildings that are still there, and the only reason why they're still there is because they're made out of very, very, very thick brick walls, and it's very expensive to tear it down. So they'll be there until
somebody's fire got the money.
Them out.
Right.
No, fire or something else takes them down, because in Jersey by the Lincoln, by the Holland Tunnel, there was these refrigerated warehouses, and again, heavy, heavy brick buildings, very thick, and they stood from the turn of the century until, like, I think maybe 10 years ago, mm-hmm. where one had a fire, and I think the fire was burning for a couple of days before anybody realized it was burning.
Wow.
And then by that point, when they tried to put it out, the building was toast. So now it's Home Depot.
Gosh.
Yeah, so it all collapsed, and now it's Home Depot.
Ignominious ending for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, kind of a fun question, David. I was just thinking about this because and maybe this was going to be your answer. But I remember once you talked about Christmas trees being brought in on the High Line. What's possibly the most unusual item that's being delivered on your railroad?
All right. Well, Christmas trees were delivered to the 30th Street Yard. Okay. And I have photographs of bulkhead flats, 40-foot bulkhead flats loaded with Christmas trees. They were brought in, you know, so because think about it today, how you get Christmas trees into urban areas, trucks.
Right.
Well, there was, you know, up until the George Washington Bridge was built, there's no real place to bring large trucks into Manhattan. Everything came over, like, you know, the 147th Street Bridge from the Bronx off of, I don't even think the Major Deegan was built yet, when it was built, I mean, it didn't really get you into Manhattan that well. You still had to take the local streets like Park Avenue to get down. You had to cross all those little tiny bridges. So anything that had to come down came down. I could tell you weird things that came on the layout during the war. Any aircraft guns were delivered to parts of Manhattan. There's a famous picture in a Dan Bernanke book. He labeled it as a 1946, but there's some a good friend of mine, Vince Lee, did some research on some of the cars and was able to place the picture on 28th Street, East 28th Street, as 1943. And you could clearly see an anti-aircraft gun sitting in the middle of the yard.
Wow.
It's towards Lipschultz. I don't know why it was there. I don't know if it was being transported or anything like that. Sadly, in the harbor, mortuary trains in the 40s, late 40s, basically bringing GIs back to the United States.
Okay.
They were brought in and trucked over, but the Pullman cars that they put over steel over the windows or okay. aluminum over the windows or tin to give them the privacy. And as you know, Pullmans have air conditioning.
Right.
And they're brought over to the Brooklyn Army Terminal and the bodies were brought there and then from there shipped across the river. So they wouldn't have been on my layout, but they definitely at the end of World War II, they would have been as they were repatriating the bodies and stuff right. like that. That would happen. But the very last load on the High Line is frozen turkeys.
Oh, how about that?
1980, frozen turkeys. So, but you had everything. I mean, like I said before, AT&T had its research facility there. They did not have anything that came off of that. They didn't have rail service, but, you know, you went through it, so it was a real cool-looking building.
Right.
But you had Radio Row, which is anybody who's old enough to remember when they built the World Trade Center. What they tore down to build the World Trade Center was Radio Row. And by that, I don't mean radio broadcasters, but basically – if you wanted parts for radios, if you wanted vacuum tubes, that was the place to go get them. And a lot of that stuff was delivered from manufacturers all over the country. There was a lot of things made in New York. Armalite Industries had a factory in Manhattan. So guns were made in New York. God forbid that ever happens today. there was a lot of things that were made in New York. And end of the 40s, at the end of World War II, the city fathers decided that they definitely wanted to turn the city from a blue-collar city to a white-collar city, so a lot of stuff stopped being manufactured in New York. My mother was a seamstress. She was in the Ladies' Garment Worker Union, a proud union member, and her job got shipped over to overseas to China. I think actually her job got shipped over to Taiwan, and that whole industry died there. But, you know, fabrics.
Right.
Right. They had to come into the city somehow, and they were, you know. And then, you know, another thing was railroads were considered passe, and so a lot of stuff came into trucks, via trucks, and our pollution spiked, go figure. There was a lot of other things that brought milk. A lot of milk was bottled in Manhattan, so the milk cars would come in with, you know, the GPX milk tank cars would come in, and it would bottle them, which is really interesting for me. Horses were a staple of New York delivering milk until the 50s, but really 40s, they stopped really replacing the horses, and most at the end of the 40s, that is, and most of the reason why, because of the war surplus of trucks, and all these people, all these soldiers who came back learned how to drive trucks, so you had a skill set that was developed during the war, and a lot of that stuff went away at that point. And then what's interesting is the horses knew the route, so the horses would walk the route, and the guy would deliver the milk and ice, mm-hmm. you know, because they delivered ice that way, and ice was brought in by the railroads also. And the horse, if the horse thought you were taking too long, he'd go on to the next one. So it's pretty interesting, the history of New York at that period. I chose 47 because that's the year my parents met in New York.
Oh, okay. I always wondered why the significance of the year. Okay.
Yeah, which is really funny because they grew up about 11 miles apart on the island of Puerto Rico, and then they moved to Manhattan after the war. My dad mustered out and went to New York, and my mother, you know, left and came up here. And he lived in the village, and she lived on 116th Street and Park Avenue, which is not a nice neighborhood. Wasn't then, wasn't now. And that's it. That's why I'm here.
Okay. How about that?
But who thought that two short Puerto Rican parents would give birth to a 6.5-foot-tall Puerto Rican kid? So that's me. And, you know, the other cool thing is that meat was also brought down on the New York Central. And, you know, when I was first researching the project, I thought there was one meat market, which is the one everybody knows of in the 70s, the infamous meat market, and not for meat. For those of you wanting to know, it's a family show. I can't go into details. But you should, if you're over the age of 18, you should go look at the Manhattan meat markets in the 70s, and you can't be squeamish. But there were several, and there were several milk markets. There was some up by the George Washington Bridge. There was some up at about 125th Street. The remnants of these buildings are still visible, and they're oddly shaped because they're long and thin, and they're basically right next to the tracks, which are still there. Amtrak uses them now.
Okay.
They've actually obviously been improved, and they're no longer right next to the building, you know, because it was a four-track main line. And at that point, two tracks in some spots, but mostly four tracks. And El Jefe, El Presidente, built his Trump Towers over most of 72nd Street Yard,
right?
Which had a roundhouse, but no coaling tower for steam. Go figure.
How about that? Okay.
It had the late, great friend of mine who basically looked just like Arthur Fonzarelli. Oh, God. Having a senior moment, I can't remember his name, but he and I would argue how they would load coal in at 72nd Street, because that was the steam facilities for the west side of Manhattan. And one day I'm looking at a photograph, and it's a very bad photograph, and he had a better version of it, and floating in midair is a hopper. It was a couple of hoppers. And what they did is, the Central did this in a few places, they would just build a trestle, put hoppers on them, and then they would dump the coal. And they had what's called a Red Devil coal loader, which would basically is this, they'd dump the coal into the Red Devil, and then it would basically use a series of conveyor belts and put this into locomotives. So the locomotives were to the left and to the right of this coal and trestle.
Right.
And, as it turns out, I think the only people who made the Red Devil is Oriental, and it was about $1,000, $900 for it. And he was building that yard, and when he was building the yard, he discovered he needed four of them, and he's trying to figure out how to manufacture, you know, three of them. But he figured he'd buy one and then duplicate it, but unfortunately, he didn't have a chance. Rob, what was it? Sinisi, I don't believe his name. Ron Parisi.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry. Ron Parisi, God rest his soul. Gentlemen, you have not seen a clinic in TC. Ron do one of his clinics about the west side of Manhattan. He was a photographer, and he always managed to get some really pretty young lady in his photographs, and he'd always refer to him as La Chicas. And he was a character. God, I miss him terribly. The hobby is a sadder place without him. He was a gentleman, and he was willing to talk to kids and to people in old parts like me about what happened, how things worked. He shared his research, and he was building that yard, and unfortunately he passed way too young.
Yes, you say he was not. I've heard of the Fonz before, and so I know he wasn't that old.
No, he was basically, I would say he was retired. I think he was in his late 60s, maybe 70-ish, but okay. Definitely not what I would consider old. Of course, when I was 30, I considered myself ancient, but at this point, I just turned 57. But
right.
All right, so, Dave, as we look at the list here, I want to ask you, I've always been kind of curious about this. What's your personal favorite spot so far on the railroad?
The bar.
Yes.
I love the car float yards more than anything else. I like, because they're the most, I could literally operate them by myself or with one person, and it's a different operating theater when you're operating with one person, mm-hmm. then when you have a room full of people.
Right.
It's more intimate. It's more, you can get into the more esoteric things like how to empty the car float out, how to load it. There's a lot more things you could pay attention to. One of the things that I started doing recently is doing sub switch lists, which basically throws everybody for a loop. And that is, specifically, like yards like 27th Street used to get automobiles, and if they had the 50-foot automobile boxcars with the bay doors, you can't unload those effectively on the side door because okay. they're basically designed to, you know, to roll the cars out the front. The 50-foot cars are, you know, the cars are on really well-engineered dollies. And or like a gimbal system where they could literally, it's almost like a pallet jack where they pull the car out. I never really appreciated that until I saw someone who built a 50-foot automobile box car
right.
with the automobiles and the roof and the one of the panels come off so you could see how the cars are in there. And it's like, I want to say it was two cars.
Mm-hmm.
In the 50-foot, because you're talking about 1940s cars, which are, you know, like tanks by today's standards. They're not Nashes.
Right.
I mean, these are Fords.
Right.
And stuff like that. You probably put 10 of them in a Nash. And they're not Vegas that are stacked, you know, the stack packs.
Right.
You guys know what the stack packs are, where they
Yeah,
I mean, that was, that died.
Side mode, yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, that was an interesting idea. You had this really monstrous... my jack that would basically go up and it had a pole and it would like lock onto the side of an auto rack and then lower the car down and you'd unbolt the car because it was basically chained in place and then drive it off. Mm-hmm. And whatever many cars you could fit, I have no idea because that's newfangled stuff for me. That's 1960s, 70s technology.
Right.
But back in the 40s, they came in these 50-foot, 40-foot cars, and they had these, you know, the Proto 2000 cars, which were brand new then. They would have the doors that would basically open up, and you could drive the car out the front, and it'd be one or two decks or something like that, depending on what they were carrying. And I believe they were all one deck. But they would have them on these jacks that they could angle them. So you could basically, if you've seen tractor-trailers being driven down the road, being delivered, where they have one sitting on the fifth wheel, and then one, okay. then the next one's attached to that one in the same spot, and attached to that one, and they're pulling like four or five tractor trailers that way, into delivering them. So it's the same thing, but inside of a boxcar. So these cars were designed to be pulled out those bay doors. So on 27th Street, I have these subtasks, which is basically a small switch list, which basically makes you move those cars from the opening at the end of the building and put another one in there. And that's supposed to be happening while I'm swapping out the car float, because I don't have automated car float, you know, restocking. It basically, okay. I manually do it. I never got around to the actual task of making a what's called a shotgun staging for it, which is basically, I'm sorry, Gatling gun staging, which is basically you have multiple car floats on what looks like a Ferris wheel. So you're done with one, you rotate it, and another car float comes up. I'd love to build one, but I don't want to spend the time engineering it. Mm. I want to run it. And the amount of work it would take to do it by the time I'm done, you know, would it really improve operations? And that is my first rule, and that should be always your first rule whenever you're thinking about making a modification to your layout. If it does not improve operations, or if it does not improve the scenery of the layout, then you really have to consider whether it's worth doing.
Right, right. Now that makes sense.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
One of my new things that I have, and I've got to find somebody who could get this into my head, because I can't put my hands around it because I got 4,000 things going on at the same time, is I want to do RFIDs.
Okay, yes. Mm-hmm.
And I want to put that on the I want to make my life a little easier and use the RFIDs for the harbor and to generate the switch list that way. Right now I'm using a cumbersome computer-controlled system. You know, basically it's an automated spreadsheet. But it has some glitches in it that are that could make for some interesting operations. One of the things is if instead of putting CMO, you put GMO, you got people hunting for cars that are right. not there. Or if you Fatfinger, or if you're dyslexic and you put car 8505 instead of 508.
Right.
You know, all of a sudden you're looking for a car that's not there. So the problem is that switch lists are not self-healing. So
right.
when you make a mistake like that, you basically have to go in and fix it. And the third person who would be operating the yard would be the agent. And I've done away with the agent job, but, you know, because mostly everything is pre-staged before you get there, so it's just switching out the cars and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but really, to answer your question, car floats.
Right.
Car float yards are my first love. Eventually, if I do something different, it'll be more mainline running.
Okay.
But that's another bridge to burn later on.
Right. Gotcha. Okay, very good.
Yeah, I must admit, that's probably one of my favorite parts, too.
And Jim Homoki wins because he has a full bar and he has a top shelf.
Okay, so the VertiPack, in case you want to know, it held 30 Vegas.
Wow. That's impressive.
15 per side.
Wow, that is that. Was that 86-foot car, an 89-foot car?
I'm looking on Wikipedia, and I just caught the edge of it. So let me give it a minute here. But
that's pretty good considering. Well, how much...
I think you figure the average car is, you know, 8 foot wide, so it almost have to be. 15 would be, you know, 120 feet. So I'm wondering if it was a couple of cars put together the way they did it or something. But it was called the VertiPack.
Yeah, but how many Vegas could they sell? Because those were cheap when I was a kid. You could pick
them
for
cheap.
About $500.
Yeah, and I can remember guys putting 327s in them and stuff.
Yeah, the big block V8s, so small block V8s in them. That you had to cut away, firewall.
You had to sit in the back seat on that, yeah.
Yeah, well, I'd had to sit in the back seat no matter what and take the front seat out. Because if you had legs, you didn't sit in the front. But yeah. I knew somebody who had one, and whenever you rev the engine, the car would literally dip down to one side.
Oh, man.
The torque from the engine, yeah.
So it had its own P factor.
Yeah.
Man.
All right, guys. I'm going to have to run.
So. Oh, well, thanks for coming on with us. I really appreciate it, my brother.
Hey, no, it's great catching up with you, Dave. Honest.
Good talking to you, too. We got to meet up at the MARPM.
That would be a production value right there.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You should do a podcast from the MARPM.
I've been thinking about that, actually.
Live from Virginia.
Yeah. Yeah, I was actually thinking about that because I'm planning on being there. I already put my money in, and so I'm planning on driving down, I think, Thursday night, and so that I'm there first thing Friday morning.
And then, yeah, I'm thinking about taking the train, believe it or not.
Oh, nice.
Well, let me know if you need somebody to pick you up.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Get one of you guys to pick me up. So Sweet. That'd be a danger.
And unlike last year, where all I could eat is soup, I can actually have a sandwich this year.
Wow.
Oh, dude. Living the Class A dream.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, Dave, let's not take so long, buddy.
No problem. All right, good. I'm looking forward to seeing you in September, right?
Yes.
Yep.
To round it off, Dave, one of my favorite things is Obsessions. Love Obsessions at the New York Harbor Railroad. You've been doing them for years now. I forget how many years you're up to.
Started in 2012.
Okay. All right.
2008, I started building the layout, and the first series of Obsessions were 2012. And if you remember, we've been operating every calendar today for 1947. We're up to February 1st.
Okay.
Wow. 31 days in January, so that's 62 obsessions with the new system, and we had about 60 obsessions with the old system and with the old plan, so you're talking about over 100 obsessions, 120 obsessions at this point.
Right.
Over the time. It's not including the mini-ops, which the car float ops, which I could literally do one a week if I get I get somebody to show up.
Right.
I want to do it myself because it's a lot of fun. And we, you know, it's like what I said earlier today with the variable crew sizes. I don't have to worry about getting 20 people to show up or 12 people to go. If I get 2, 4, 1.
Right.
I could have an obsession.
Right.
Which I think gives me a lot of flexibility the layouts just don't have. I have friends and acquaintances who, if they don't get a certain number of people, they have to cancel.
Right. Which is so hard.
And again, like I said earlier, it's a curse too, because all these people go, well, you could always scale down. But if you get an odd number, like I need six to eight to operate the High Line and 33rd Street.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and to operate them together. If not, it's a split. So I have done that where I didn't have enough crew, so I operate one, and then the next month I operate the other.
Okay.
And so it's I've had more obsessions like that than I care to think about. had some obsessions where we didn't have enough people for the car float yards.
Right.
So, but when you design a layout to be flexible and variable, it saves your bacon every now and then. You don't have to have a full crew to operate.
Right. No, that's good.
And we've talked about operations. The number one thing I tell people is value your crew's time. Don't if you don't have the time to set up and to be ready for people, consider postponing a week, a month, or whatever, because people give up their family time, their free time, and they come over to help you out to see your vision through. Mm-hmm. The very least you can be is prepared.
Well, that actually segues nice into my final question for you, and that is getting ready for an obsession. What are some of the things that you need to know? And that's definitely one of them.
Well, like if you need 20 people, that's the most important thing to know. The other thing is that for me, the way an op session works out is simple. I'll give you an idea. I'm going to have an op session on Friday. Let's just say Friday. And it is Saturday. Saturday, I just got off of work from Friday. I spent some time with the family Friday doing family things. I get up with the chickens. I go downstairs, and I set up car floats for one of the yards.
Okay.
2-3 car floats, boom. That's all I do. The next day, Sunday, I'll do the same thing. I'll set up the other car float yard. One of the things I'll do is that I have the waybills pre-done. I just change the dates on the waybill, change a couple of, it depends on the day of the op session. So if it's a Saturday, like my next session is February 1st, which is a Saturday, the pacemaker doesn't run. So okay. When I print out, when I send my switch list, not my switches, when I send my waybills to be printed by Staples, I make sure that I don't send the BN2 and BN3, which is the both sides of the pacemaker.
Okay.
The human pro. So I cut that out. And then when I do a Sunday, I don't have BN2 or BN3, and I don't have KN4 and KN3, which is basically the New England version of the pacemaker.
Okay.
So I cut those out, so I have less trains. So it makes life at least. So I have these waybills. So what I will do is when I'm watching TV Sunday night, I'll cut out the waybills, and I'll put them in train order, put them in also in station order. So I know that when I put the trains together on Monday, when I start putting the trains together, I'll try and do 3 or 4 trains on Monday, 3 or 4 trains on Tuesday, 3 or 4 trains on Wednesday. And it's basically 10 trains that go on the High Line and on the 33rd Street. So if I do it 3-3-3 or 4-4-4, I'll be done.
Okay. Okay.
A couple of days. And by what I'm talking about basically is when I have the waybills in order, I put the cars in order of how they're going to be dropped in the location, with the last cars being the cars making it all the way to the end, or, you know, when they go to 33rd Street, how they have to be broken up to get to one side of the yard or the other. So they have to be blocked. And a lot of people would say, well, wherever they show up, that's how they should be, you know, you just put them together. Well, 33rd Street is not a classification yard, it's a terminal. So the classification yard is 72nd Street. That all that work would have been done at 72nd Street. So okay. So to represent that, when they're bringing the trains in, they're coming in blocked order, and the crews at 33rd Street, all they're doing is breaking up the cuts from the train coming in and putting them where they belong. And then, you know, with my waybill system, they put down the time that the cars are spotted. The cars have a time it takes to empty. Certain cars have to be cleaned. You know, there's a list of cars that need to be cleaned, you know, from different industries. That takes time. They go to a clean-out track, they clean down, and then they go to the return track, the departure track, to be sent out. Or they get sent to a different part of the yard to be reloaded. So basically working about 3 to 5 days, and I'm talking about a couple hours. I'm not talking about spending days, you know, like 4 or 5 hours, like an hour or two a night. I can get the whole thing staged in about 3 hours, in 3 nights.
Okay.
3 to 5 nights. If I had to, and I have done it, it's not fun, I could do it in one day. That when I do that, I tend to make more mistakes. I tend to get the wrong cars. So I take my time, and, you know, I listen to music while I'm doing it, and I try to make sure that I get appropriate cars but not identical cars. So one of the things that happens is I have a quirky photographic memory. So when I go to people's houses and I run their trains and they have the same train doing the same job every day, which happens on mine, it happens on most because it's all based on schedules. But on some of the layouts, it's the same exact cars, same exact road numbers. I tend to remember them. It gets me into trouble now and then because Harold figured that I was figuring these things out, and I wasn't even really looking at the waybills anymore. I just knew them because I've been operating there for 20, 25 years, and I started doing that. So he started switching cars up on me, and I'm like, uh-oh. So I do that mostly because, in reality, if you're getting meats or you're getting cattle or you're getting cars from specific industries going to specific industries, you're going to get similar cars, similar roads. So every now and then I'll throw in a curve, have a car that basically is in the same region but was heading in this direction anyway, or a car from another region that's going to be returned to a different place. So it's just to mix things up.
Okay.
And again, I want to have fun. I want everybody else to have fun and to enjoy it. It's a question of, you can't, if you have obsessions and people stop coming, this generally is a comment to your standards, your track standards, or it could just be that people are not having a good time. So, like I said, I work a lot of hours in a job that I enjoy, but at the same point, you know, I get paid for that. This is for fun. I don't want anybody to do this and think that at the end that I owe them a paycheck because I put them through hell.
Right.
You know, I want, you know, one of my, right, my big thing, you hear me say it all the time, I want to keep people busy. If you're not so busy that you could check out the mistakes I made on track work or the number of ties that have spikes, then I haven't done my job. My job is to keep you busy so you're operating, you're concentrating on moving freight.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Okay.
And when all else fails, bourbon.
Oh, yeah. I can get by. Well, or single malt scotch.
Yeah. No tequila. That just wind up in a bathtub with ice.
Yeah, I remember hearing the phrase, stay away from the tequila or something like that.
I have the good stuff. I have Don Julio 1942, which is really good. It doesn't have that, when people have bad tequila, when they take a shot of it, they look like they just had a seizure on one side of their face.
Mm-hmm.
That's the bad stuff. The stuff I got is really smooth, is really nice stuff. It's also $120 a bottle. So I'm a firm believer, you get what you pay for.
Yeah, I agree. One of my personal favorites would be the Macallan. I'm a sucker for that. But I'm sorry, what one did you just say? Let me write that down.
Don Julio. 1942.
Okay.
It's expensive by the shot.
Right.
I had a bartender friend who, I never liked tequila, and she said, because you've always had the wrong one, and she convinced me to try some. I had a couple of shots of it. And I woke up in my room with my kidney, so I guess it was a good thing. The joke is, tequila pretends to be your friend and then leaves you in a bathtub.
Dave, thank you so much for coming on tonight and sharing with us again about the New York Harbor Railroad. It's been great getting caught up with you, and we really appreciate your time.
I really had a good time coming on tonight, and there's future stuff coming down the pipe with the New York Harbor. And eventually, we're going to have some more fun, more operating session. The coronavirus is not going to last forever. And that will be replaced by Corona Light with limes. So, like I said, I have op sessions on a monthly basis. Unless the governor physically comes to my house and tells me I can't have one, we're going to have one in July.
Right.
And everything should be good. Until then, Tim, be safe. You have a family and a wonderful wife and a wonderful kid.
Thank you.
You should take care of them and take care of yourself. As for me, I'm going to sell Volvos.
That's what you're doing now.
No, I actually work for a company called Rent the Runway, okay, which in my defense, I thought was an aviation company. But it turns out to be runway, as in women walking on a runway.
Okay, gotcha.
It's Netflix for high-end women's clothing. For those guys who are married, ask your wives. They'll tell you what it is.
Okay.
Oh, that's awesome.
And of course, what we open the show with, we close the show with, the Model Railcast theme. Till next time, guys.
You've been listening to the Model Railcast Show. You can find us at www.modelrailcastshow.com or on Facebook at Friends of MRCS, and look for us on iTunes. Don't miss your other great model railroading podcasts out there, The Scotty Mason Show, Model Rail Radio, A Modeler's Life, and the Model Railroad Hobbyist Podcast. And drop us a line if we miss mentioning you. This is Amy Perkins for the Model Railcast Show. Have a great week.